Dr. Samantha Boardman is a positive psychiatrist with a private practice in Manhattan. She's a clinical instructor in psychiatry and assistant attending psychiatrist at the Cornell Medical College. She received her BA from Harvard University and a medical degree from Cornell University. Dr. Boardman has been published in respected industry journals, including Translational Neuroscience, the American Journal of Psychiatry, and the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. She just released her brand new book, Everyday Vitality, Turning Stress into Strength, which walks readers through the science-backed process of building resilience and countering stress. It's something we all need today, so it's an absolute pleasure to welcome Dr. Samantha Boardman to the show. Samantha, I'm so excited to have you on the show. You just had a morning show, a segment this morning. You're on your book tour for Everyday Vitality, and I'm so thankful that I'm getting this hour with you today to ask you all the big questions. We've all had such a heavy 2020. Now we're in 2021, and we need this everyday vitality. So thank you for loaning us your time and giving us your time and sharing your expertise.
Thank you, Kelly. It's such a pleasure to be here. I love what you do and I love what you share. So thank you. It's an honor.
Right back at you. So let's start from where you started. Can you tell me a bit about your journey into positive psychiatry and what it means to be a positive psychiatrist?
Sure. You know, I sort of had that very traditional training. I went to medical school and then I did a residency in psychiatry. And in medical school, you just spend a lot of time focusing on what's wrong with somebody. And that's really like your job. You sort of laser sort of focus and hone in on what's the problem, what's the diagnosis, what's the person's chief complaint. And you palpate prostates, you percuss lungs, like you're doing things that are looking for problems and trying to make them less bad. And I was pretty good at that. And then I was drawn to psychiatry because it sort of combined my interest in the humanities and in people's stories, also with the brain and with the science. So I sort of liked that collision. And I sort of thought it would get me closer to those bigger questions, like, you know, what's the meaning of life? What is it all for, kind of thing. But pretty quickly, you know, it takes a very similar sort of, it replicates what you do in medicine, is you're just looking for the problem, the diagnosis, and how can I make this person feel less bad? And even how can I bring them back to baseline? Like, kind of like, what is their minimal level of functioning? And let me get them back to that. And it was about 10 years ago, I was seeing a patient, a woman, interesting woman. She had three kids who were under like the age of 8, and she was just overwhelmed. She didn't qualify for that, you know, formal diagnosis of depression. She didn't check all the boxes, but she just, you know, was far from thriving and conflicts with her husband, overwhelmed with the kids. And I, you know, could get her kind of back to her baseline, but we weren't really, you know, doing anything beyond that. And I actually thought we were making progress because I was kind of dialing down her problems and would talk a lot about her issues when she would come and see me. And one day, about 8 weeks into treatment, she just came in and said, you know what? I just hate coming here sometimes. All we ever do is talk about what's wrong in my life. And even sometimes I'm having a pretty good day and I have to think about, what can I complain about? What can I vent about? Like, this is this stage where I do that. And, you know, we never talk about anything else. And it was like a wake-up call for me in that I realized she was 100% right. You know, we were really focused on the conflict with the husband, on, you know, her stress levels and her frustration, and kind of trying to dial that down. But we never talked about really her strengths, like what she loved doing, her interests, like what she could build upon. And it got me to go back to school where I studied positive psychology, and I got a master's in positive psychology that is, you know, basically the opposite of everything I learned in medical school. Like, you study optimism, you study resilience, you study post-traumatic growth. I mean, these are all, you know, words. Like, resilience is not a word that I had heard in medical school at all. I think now it's a word thrown around a lot. You know, the other day my vet had told me my dog needs to be more resilient because she's sort of ornery and barks at other dogs. I've got a new like shampoo that's supposed to make my hair more resilient. So now it's something I think we do hear all the time, but it's, you know, I guess it was just, it really broadened the way I think about mental health being so much more than the absence of illness, and how can you help patients find wellness within their illness. And even, you know, people who don't necessarily qualify for a, you know, a diagnosis, but who just, how do they find strength within their everyday stress? And how can we hold both of those, your stress and your strength, side by side? And it's not one or the other. And for so long, I think a lot of that was just dismissed as like icing on the cake, like, oh, you know, let's just get this person back to baseline. That stuff's sort of, you know, on the side, that can wait. And I think it's really important to put that like front and center in our everyday lives and in treatment as well.
Wow. There's so much to unpack there, because I would say the woman, the mother that you worked with, that was sort of my experience in therapy. I always had short bouts of therapy around specific issues, a really bad breakup, a bad delivery, you know, something like that. And then it does feel like at a certain point, if you continue those sessions, that then all these other things are coming up. And there's, I think, two schools of thought, like we need to work on all the other things that are coming up and work through all those things. I found that, you know, there was that time for me to go, well, yeah, and then this bothers me about Chris, and that bothers me about my parents, and this bothers me about my job or the people I work with or whatever it is. And it was things that never were really conscious thoughts until I had this space to really unpack them or talk about them. But then they became conscious in the everyday of like, yeah, it really bothers me that you unpack the dishwasher that way, or that you have to do this that way. And then it became that those were thoughts that I was having regularly that I never had before. And is that something, I mean, because when I think about positive psychology or psychiatry, and I think about optimism, use the word resilience, post-traumatic growth, like those feel really powerful. Those feel like they're going to put you back in your life to feel great about your life. Like, I can do this, I got this, and other, you know, those annoying things aren't kind of coming up as often. Can you explain what your sessions would look like, or how it works to stay in that positive place, stay in your strength and your stress at the same time?
Yeah, you know, it's completely like a wildly different approach, I think, to health. And before, I think it was sort of pathogenesis that I was focused on, which is really the study and treatment of disease. And now I think of salutogenesis, which is like the study and the creation of health. And, you know, I ask patients, like I'll go through like, you know, and maybe in the first session when I meet them too, and it's depending on who they are and where they are at that moment. But, you know, tell me about you at your best. You know, I want to hear about that. I'll ask them to even consider writing something about that so I can figure out like who is the version of themselves that they would like to be, and that they can tap into that person. And one thing, I like another exercise I'll do is ask them to take this sort of strengths survey, and it generates the top five strengths that you have. It might be curiosity or perseverance or love of beauty or something like that. And then say, you know, we'll do these exercises of use your strength in a new way this week. Like, how are you going to use your strength of curiosity? And even asking questions like, how do you want to feel when you come back here next week? Like, what are you hoping to do in that way? And kind of asking them to close that intention action gap, because a lot of the things I think in the book I talk about is happiness isn't all in your head, you know, like it's in the actions you take, the connections you make, and really how you participate. It's in that embodied health. And so I think, you know, you can have this amazing insight in therapy of like, wow, maybe that's why I do what I do. It's because my mom did that thing or whatever. But unless, you know, that light bulb might go off, but unless you're translating that into something in your life, like you still might be then, you know, sitting on the couch, kind of just hanging out. And just like, I'm glad that that insight occurred, but unless it's sort of actually, you know, I guess embodied or manifesting somehow, it's probably not going to help you that much. So how do you get mental health like sort of out into your world, and that you are, you know, aligning your values and your actions? And at the very beginning, I usually ask patients to, you know, think about what are their like top three values? Like, what do you value most in your life? And it's actually something people don't think about all that much. And so I'll even like leave it as a homework to consider. And, you know, it's not something that even they've spent that much time reflecting on. And then I'll ask them, like, how do you spend your free time? And it's often really like, you know, awakening when you're like, oh my goodness, this gulf between what I really care about. And yeah, well, actually last Saturday I fell into that like social media hole. And then I, you know, watch Netflix like back to back. Like, you know, I watched like 11 episodes of the show I was catching up on or whatever. And, you know, the closer you can have your values overlap with your actions, I think that really can help fortify you even in the face of everyday stress. And also really, I think that can sort of help you manage the hassles and feel more resilient in your everyday way. And also like in other, in larger ways.
It makes me so happy to hear you say happiness isn't in your head and it's in these actions, because what it sounds like is you're more of a coach or a team member, a support, someone holding them accountable to do things that make them feel like they've made growth or they've done something great for themselves. And maybe they are taking those values and aligning those with their actions in between your sessions to feel better about themselves. What you just said, I mean, for me personally, when I think about my values, it's making and eating healthy food, really, really strong, like present relationships with my family and friends, and then like outdoor sweaty activity, like whether that's yoga or surfing or the beach or hiking. Like, and if I've had a weekend where we've gone to the farm and got some veggies and we've gone to the beach as together, like Dash is on the bike and we're going to the farm, or we're all together and we're at the beach, like I feel like a full day of podcasting, clients, 100 emails, you know, getting out of stock and protein powder, I'm like, I got this because I went to the beach and we got a fridge full of food. Like it's amazing that you've just, I feel like that should be an aha moment for all the therapists who are listening, that this is the way that you create, help people create the power, or have the power in their own life to feel their best.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'd like to put myself out of business entirely, you know, like that I didn't, like that, you know, I didn't need to sort of prioritize this or make like such a big deal, I think, about it. And in my line of work, it really is a sort of, you know, icing on the cake kind of thing, or like, oh, let's just wait for that. That's not so important. And I think it's so central to how we feel. And when we're sort of embodying what we care about and what we stand for, it's revitalizes us, you know, so you can actually have that weekend and go back on a Monday and feel really strong. But had you been like a couch potato, you would feel so depleted heading into Monday. And if you weren't embodying the values the way you say you do.
Other than sitting down with a client and saying, tell me about like when you feel your best and trying to identify those values, how do you support your clients to set goals and kind of bring their values in alignment with those actions? Do you, like, what are you expecting of them? Because I think they're, I would say in nutrition, working with clients, it seems like they come to me with 100 things that they want to change and do. And that feels overwhelming to me, but I'm just curious what your practice looks like in that actual, like the tangible steps you take to help people make that alignment.
Yeah. Well, cause I think it's so like devitalizing when you feel like you're a tumbleweed in your everyday life, like, you know, your schedule, everything is sort of, you're blown about by that. Even how you eat, you're like, oh, I'm hungry, I'm just going to grab that like candy bar in my bag or whatever, those types of things. So being much more intentional and deliberate about what you're doing and what are the things that you actually have some agency over and what you can control. And so one way I talk about closing this intention action gap would be what's something really specific. And as you say, sometimes when there's so many things, you know, it's overwhelming. Let's be as specific as we can. Like, what's one thing you feel like you want to do more of? And it might be, I feel like I when I'm with my family, I'm not really there. I'm always on my phone. You know, how do I connect better? And so I asked them to set WHOOP goals. And this is out of research that Gabriella Tugin has done at NYU and thinking about, okay, W-O-O-P. And the W stands for like, what's your wish? And that would be like, I wish I was like on my phone less and I was more present. Then the first O stands for, what would the outcome of that be like for you? You know, like, I just feel like more connected. I'd feel whatever. And like really get them to consider and write down like how they would feel about doing, accomplishing that goal. And then the next O is, well, what's the obstacle to that? Okay. So it might be like, well, the phone's always on the table or it's in my pocket and I feel it vibrating. And even if it's not there, I feel like it's a phantom vibration. Then I'll go find it anyway. So like really identifying very specifically what that is. And then the P stands for, what's your plan now? Okay. Maybe I'm going to turn it off when I'm, you know, with my family, when I'm at home, I'm going to leave it in the kitchen, so I'm not like sitting around with it, you know, whatever those, like, so you can really not just have this wish in your head, because actually, like, positive thinking, you know, might not get you anywhere. And there's even research around that that shows that people just thinking positively about weight loss, about saving money, or just like kind of having thinking happy thoughts might feel good in the moment, but it's not going to get you any closer to that goal. So I think with the, it's called like mental contrasting, this whoop exercise, is it helps you close that intention action gap and, you know, do that thing that you want to do. And part of that plan could be scheduling it. So when are you going to then go for a walk with your friend? You know, like, what time? Would that be at 5 p.m., you know, this afternoon? Because it can't be like, oh, I just want to walk more or whatever. How do you really kind of make it concrete and then build it into their daily life? And I think a lot of well-being right now, like, you've got to, like, there's this idea that you have to like download it or buy it or eat, pray, love your way to it and retreat somewhere and go and find yourself. And like, the thing is, a lot of this is available to us. We just have to prioritize it. And, you know, I always say, like, you can stop worrying about finding yourself. Like, there are so many versions of you. And when we talk about finding yourself, it's like this idea that like there's some kernel of truth deep within there. And if you just focus enough internally, you can reveal that person. And it's not really true. Like, it's the idea, like, you're constantly in the process of becoming and changing. And the person you are this morning is not the person you're going to be this afternoon. And there are better versions of ourselves, or, you know, than there are there, like, you know, the versions of ourselves that we're always, you know, maybe thinking like, oh, I'm not so proud of the way I did that. And I even tell my patients sometimes, like, you can stop, even, you don't have to be yourself at all. Like, especially when you're super stressed out, think of somebody you admire. What would they do in this moment? You know, like, how would they handle this stress? You know, and it can kind of put some distance. It gives you a little bit of perspective, because I think that even like, if you think about what kind of advice would I give to a friend who is going through this moment, is another like self-distancing technique. That's what it's called in psychology. Because when you're just so immersed in your emotions and you're just swimming in them, it's really hard to sort of see past them. And we can just sometimes ruminate a lot about them. And when you can take some distance or think, what would I tell a friend right now? Or what would somebody I admire do? That you're like, ah, maybe I can. It just opens up, you know, the door a little bit. And I think the crack, you know, then lets some light shine through that you can be like, oh, maybe I could try that. And it like lifts us out of ourselves and out of our own heads.
Now, that's a really beautiful way to support people to get through those really tough moments, because it's exactly what you said. The rumination happens. It sort of feels like tunnel vision. You feel like the adrenaline starts to pump and you can't see your way out of it. I just, you know, had a thought, because we were talking before the podcast about dropping my son off at school and him having such a hard transition into preschool. Day one was great, but he doesn't like the birthday song, and they sang the birthday song. So the last couple hours of that day was so upsetting to him. And so today, his second day of school, it's a really hard transition. So even just thinking, what would I tell a friend to do? Like, you just saying that, you know, is getting me out of my head around that and thinking like, who's a mom that I really admire? And I really admire my mom, you know, and like, how would she have handled that? And I think, you know, I'm proud of the way I handled it. I didn't just like drop him off and run. You know, I couldn't stay the whole day. I have a work day, but I do feel like we talked about it a lot. And even before the podcast started, you know, you explained that exposure was important. So I'm thinking about all the ways that we can kind of desensitize him to that birthday song and that was great advice. So thinking just that's a great way to think through things and kind of bring you it back into the present moment instead of ruminating on things that may be upsetting.
How old is he, your son?
He's going to be 3 October 16th.
I mean, you could even ask him, you know, what, you know, with one of his stuffed animals, like, he's going to, you know, going to be somewhere. He's going off to to a school. Like, what would you tell, you know, how would you advise him? Like, even put him in that position of being the advisor in some way, because it might empower him a little bit. Like, this was what was hard for me, you know? So I think that's kind of an interesting way to get kids to also, you know, that they love to add value. You know, I think that kids actually are so empowered when they can help others. And even, you know, there's research that shows when they see their parents struggling a little bit, that they're also more likely to struggle. I think sometimes as parents, we put on this really like brave face, like nothing fazes us. Like, we, you know, we just got it going on in every way. And they don't necessarily have those glimpses of us having a hard time. And what I actually ended up going back to school during, like, when my kids were like 5 and 7. And I was like, oh, this is taking so much time away from them. And am I missing something? But actually seeing, like, me pour over homework and, you know, stay up late, I think there was maybe, or I justified it to myself that there was some value in it. But they even say, I think kids as young as 2 or 3, when they see their parent like struggle trying to open something, that then when they try something challenging right afterwards, they're much more likely to put in more effort and try a little bit harder than if the parent just is like, oh, no, I'm just going to put it away. Like, I'm not going to put that like exertion into it. So I think it sounds like you're setting a really good example.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I know. I love that. Teaching them to try again and put in the effort, because it may not, it's never going to be perfect, but you just show them that you continue to get back up and work hard and try again, and that it's going to be okay. Let's go back to the whoop, because I would like to close the loop on that and talk to you about what maybe goals you've set, the wish, the outcome, the obstacle, and the plan, what plans you've set in your life to create the life and align, close the gap between intention and action.
Sure. I mean, phones are certainly like a big place for me, and especially being around my kids as well. Like, how do I, when I'm with them, how do I give them my full attention? Also my husband. And, you know, that I realized I was really doing that when I was with my friends or with my kids, but I wasn't doing it as much with him. Like, he didn't get that level of attention with me. Like, when I was with him, I could just be staring at my phone, or sort of, I could just check out. And I read a study then saying that people, when you share a piece of chocolate with somebody and that you're both eating the same piece of chocolate, but the other person is distracted, it doesn't taste as good. And I thought, wow, every time I'm, you know, distracted on my phone, I'm unsharing a moment. So I've been really deliberate though about when I'm with him, the phone is, if it's not off, it's in another room. And, you know, my kids know where to find me. They can call me on my home phone too, or whoever needs me. And so I feel much better and connected. And so for me, my plan has really been to turn it off. Another thing that's been such a priority for me is spending time outdoors. And, you know, I think we all have nature deficit disorder. And I know just being in green space for 15 minutes kind of lifts my spirit. So I have a friend who I always walk with, and whenever I feel like not doing it, I just know she'll, you know, be disappointed and I'll leave her hanging. And so, and I never regret it. I'm always so glad I actually show up, but because we have this plan, like, there's just no breaking it. And it practically, if there's like, you know, thunder or lightning, I mean, it's the only thing that we'll get between us and our walk in the park. And, you know, just having that scheduled, it's a priority. It's on, you know, and I feel that when you have something planned with a friend, the obligation makes you show up. And there's all this research around people are happier when they exercise with a friend. It goes like above and beyond the physical benefits of it. And it's just been such a nice, like, kind of tradition or ritual we've created in the past year and a half. And it's been made in, like, truly life enhancing. And I think being in nature, walking, and being with a friend, like, you know, that's kind of like the hat trick of happiness.
Definitely. And I love that you're bringing up nature, and I love that you're bringing up exercise. So I'd like to kind of talk about what the research says in regards to creating resilience and happiness and optimism with our lifestyle choices.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I wish I had learned more in medical school and even in residency, is that, you know, sleeping, moving, eating are so important to how our brains are feeling. And one of the best interventions we have for somebody who's feeling a little bit down and depressed is to move, like, to physically move. Like, it could be going for a walk around the block. And I was even say, like, it's not necessarily even jog bra, like, you know, necessary. Like, it's just movement, even moving, like, getting out from wherever you are in a moment. Like, if you're having a meltdown at work, or you're feeling like you just can't deal, physically get up, excuse yourself, go outside for 10 minutes, it actually truly just switches how you will feel. Like, it turns a switch and you'll feel more empowered by it. But just walking 20 minutes a week, I mean, just like small things, not jog bra requiring, you know, exercise, can really be unbelievably helpful. And even what they call like incidental ambulation, that I think a lot of us have had less of because of working from home and not commuting as much, or like going to the deli during lunch and things like that. We've just been, you know, sort of staying in our houses, but how, like, to really prioritize and make it a ritual that this is something you're going to do. And I have to say, even for me, and I know this research, but unless I make myself do it every day, it's like Groundhog Day, like, oh, I don't really feel like it. I'll get more work done. And you are more productive afterwards. You're able to focus more afterwards. You are renewed and revitalized after you take those breaks. And, you know, and not bringing your phone with you. And also, I'm a big fan of when I am outdoors. Like, I love podcasts, but I don't listen to your podcast when I'm walking or, you know, in nature, because I want to hear the birds. Like, I want to sort of hear what's going on around me. And so I always recommend people to sort of be in nature naked, like without their anything in their ears, because it's so important to kind of just, I think, absorb that, and you're getting the like more benefit than if you are distracted. And I love this. I listen to your podcast when I get out of the shower.
Oh, thanks. We can listen to your episode. It's already such an amazing amount of content, just even from Whoop to thinking about what our values are and trying to align those with our actions. Just they're really powerful takeaways for people who want that resiliency. They want the happiness. So let's dive a little bit into sleeping and eating. What does the research say? Was this something that you recommended your patients before? And how does it work its way into your practice today?
I mean, just starting with like food and nutrition, I would only inquire about what people ate when I met somebody who had an eating disorder or who was very depressed and not eating enough. And, you know, this was obviously before I went back to school and was studying applied positive psychology, and really recognizing how unbelievably, you know, valuable it is that like what you're putting in your body can really shape how you feel. And there's a couple of studies, I'm thinking of one right now, that just 4 days of eating, basically it was a milkshake and like really unhealthy McMuffin-y style thing for breakfast. Not only like did you feel more sluggish and you couldn't concentrate, like you were just in a worse mood, you're more irritated, so much so that your partner realized it. This is just 4 days of just basically the Western diet.
Right.
So recognizing how impactful that was on just people's general mood and ability to get things done and feeling good about themselves. So now these days, I really like put it front and center about how many diet sodas do you drink? Like I want to hear about kind of what their day looks like, not even just what they eat, but when they eat, you know, and that also I think can really affect then how they're sleeping. I mean, these are all so related to one another. And sleep is so critical to our mental health, and that it's not something that people prioritize. You know, we set an alarm to go to bed, to wake up in the morning, but we don't set one to go to bed. And I've actually gotten patients to do that now, is set an alarm to go to bed. And that actually, you know, and that really it's the set the alarm on their phone to put it away and put it in another room, and actually having a regular alarm clock to wake you up if you need it. And the way that sleep functions, I mean, this study blew my mind, was people who are sleep deprived, other people not knowing that person sleep deprived don't want to be around them. And they actually find that sleep deprived people are, and this is the researcher's term, they are socially repulsive. Like we literally repel others when we are exhausted. And, you know, it's not even conscious to those who are around us, but I think it's sort of like how we are in the world and that irritability. And I think we are, so many of us are sleep deprived, and there are many, many different reasons, but to prioritize sleep and at least getting 7 hours a night is, you know, it also affects then what you eat the next day and how much energy you have. And if you feel like, you know, then you're more likely to cancel going to the gym the next day. And people who have better relationships also sleep better, you know, so this all feeds back in and of itself. But it's something, again, that I never thought of was a big deal when I was in, you know, studying in medical school and psychiatry, unless somebody said, hey, I've got insomnia, like, can I have some Ambien?
I've spent the last decade educating my clients, friends, family, and followers all about how their food choices impact their blood glucose. We know from research that poor glucose control is tied to a number of chronic conditions, including Alzheimer's, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, weight gain, fatigue, and sexual dysfunction. This is an enormous problem for our country. There are more than 90 million Americans with prediabetes. 70% of those people will be diabetic within 10 years, and 84% of people with prediabetes don't know they have it. We need a way to give people access to their body's own real-time data so they can make lasting changes and improve their metabolic health. That's where Levels comes in. Levels is expanding access to continuous glucose monitoring, or CGMs, and making it mainstream. They're focused on people looking to optimize their diet, improve metabolic fitness, and increase longevity. They're backed by an amazing team, including a Stanford MD. Check out my interview with Dr. Casey Means on episode 103. I'm so wildly passionate about this company that I invested personally. And that's because for years, I've taught my clients to use traditional glucometers to prick their finger before and after a meal to understand how the food choices that they were making affected them and their glucose personally. Now, CGMs and Levels specifically totally changes that game. It isn't this cumbersome finger pricking situation. You simply wear the CGM and you can immediately know how your food choices affect you, allowing you to optimize those food choices without guessing, getting you to your goals faster. Now, I'm not gonna lie. Blood sugar and glucose management is a hot topic right now, but I've been talking about it for a really long time, and my friends in Levels know that. So they have decided to give me a sneaky website where you can skip a 130,000 person wait list. And that website is levels.link/KellyLevesque. So head on over there, grab a Level CGM, and start making real change immediately. To follow along with my personal Levels experience, check out my highlight on my Instagram at Be Well by Kelly.
Well, it sounds like nutritional psychology to me. Like, you're taking the approach of how can we take these lifestyle tools and use them to support your happiness and your resilience and your optimism. And I definitely don't want to be socially repulsive. I might have felt that way for the last 6 months because I have a nine-month-old now, but you know, that's that postpartum lack of sleep, but it doesn't surprise me because a good night's sleep, there is nothing like it. The way that you feel, you feel like you can take on the world. Everything feels more positive. You do make it to the gym. You do feel like moving your body. It's the best thing ever. Absolutely. Can we talk a little bit about all of these goals and a cadence to setting them? Because I do feel like sometimes when we set a goal, we do something for a little while, like maybe you walk with your friend and you guys did it for 9 months. Let's say you fell off and someone canceled and then you guys canceled again. And then it felt easy to cancel and it fell off. I feel like that happens a lot with people and then they think that they're a failure. Can we talk about how to create resilience around your goals? And is that normal?
Well, I think a lot of the research around behavior change is like for long-term behavior change is, you know, the idea that you have to be deliberate about it. You have to be accountable. It's better if you do it with a friend. We know all that, but also a really important component of it is setbacks, and that you probably will, you know, have setbacks and you won't follow through. But, you know, is that like a moment then to like throw it all up in the air and sort of say, oh, well, I will wait till next, you know, till New Year's or my birthday next year. I mean, every day is an opportunity for a fresh start. I think it's so important. Like, in the fresh start effect is really powerful. It might be it's Monday, or I think, you know, it could be it's, you know, the first day of the month or whatever that thing is, to always like sort of start anew. And the other thing about habits too, is I think sometimes people can do the opposite of what you're talking about. Like, they can almost get so rigid and attached to like, if I don't walk at 5 o'clock, you know, my day is ruined, you know, in some way. And that can almost also make it hard, you know, and then if they actually can't do that thing that they had their, you know, heart set on or some kind of, you know, ritual that they were doing. And, you know, that importance of being flexible around our goals as well. And, you know, sometimes it's just not going to happen that day. And then not all is lost, because then sometimes I think that can be that slippery slope of like, oh, I should just eat that stuff I wanted for dinner. I didn't even get to go to the gym, and I can just make this a lost cause day. And I think kind of regaining some control over that, if it's either side of that, like either if you're sort of slipping in your goals or you're really tying, you know, be holding rigidly onto them, is being more flexible. And I think when we can take that distance and do some of those self-distancing techniques, and you can say like, what would I tell a friend right now? Or what somebody I admire, how would they handle this right now? That you can actually be a little bit more forgiving. And, you know, we're seeing numbers, you know, the rise in perfectionism is so high, especially in young women today. Like, they want to be perfect in their achievements and in their social media presence and in their social lives in every way. And, you know, I think we're much more forgiving when it comes to other people, but when it comes to ourselves, you know, either, you know, not meeting our goals or just maybe forcing when we're deviating from them, that we need to bring a little bit more of that empathy back to ourselves.
Oh, goodness. It's so true. So many times we can look at a friend and say, it's okay. You're fine. The day is not lost. Just, you know, read a good book. Don't eat the tray of brownies you made for your kids. Like, you just missed the gym. That's not a big deal, but it's exactly what you say. It's really having empathy with ourselves and getting rid of the perfectionist thoughts. How do you coach people to have flexibility around that? Is it using those self-distancing techniques, or are there any, I don't want to say like light flexibility, or because some people feel, it's funny, I'm curious if you find this in your practices, the rigidity and the perfectionism really can cause people to overreact when it doesn't go right. And that can be kind of, we're looking at all these lost hours in the day if that day goes wrong at 9 a.m. versus it going wrong at, say, or when they think it goes wrong at, say, 9 p.m. How do you coach them to have flexibility? Is there anything outside of thinking about what other people might think, or tips that you have for people when they feel like the day is lost?
I mean, one thing I'll often tell people to do is I'll say, like, be on you. Like, what's the opposite of the thing you feel like doing right now? And because what I've found is our coping strategies, like, it's so interesting, like our brains, we didn't catch up with our thinking processes to our brains. So the moment we feel threatened, you know, or there's something that didn't quite go our way, or we feel like we've lost control and we get defensive, like we go into like defense mode and like we just flip out of discovery mode. Like, we're not curious. We're shutting down. We're kind of becoming turtles and retreating and becoming super self-focused and self-immersed. And, you know, our emotions are everything to us at that moment. And again, it's sort of like, what's the opposite of the thing you feel like doing at this moment? And maybe do that. The other thing, and it's so counterintuitive, is doing something for someone else at that moment. Like, it seems like doing something that like is some form of like, you know, this is the moment. I haven't called my grandmother in 3 weeks. Like, I need to like pick up the phone and call her. You know, I'm going to the drugstore. I'm going to knock on that elderly neighbor's door and ask her if she needs something. It's so good to lift ourselves out of ourselves in those moments, because the more we immerse and the more we ruminate and like the more we sort of get into it. And then sometimes we even have these maladaptive habits of calling somebody who will co-ruminate with us, you know, and be like, wait, what happened again? Tell me about that. You know, and there's even actually sometimes parents with kids, if it's like a kid, you know, an older kid like doesn't have a great day at school, it'll be like, tell me about that again. Then, you know, tell your dad about what happened again. It's almost like they're reliving it constantly each time, you know, tell then, you know, this other friend exactly. And so you're not really getting past it. And you're just sort of in that space of immersion and of rumination, when instead it's sort of like, how can you change the story a little bit, which is then, how would you advise somebody else? Or, you know, get, if you can ask them to reimagine it, even from like, what would your future self think about this? Or if a fly were on the wall, what would they say about this? But I think we have the ability to override our, these sort of self-focused, self-immersed moments. And that's why sometimes the override, I always think of gymnasts, you know, when you think of them doing like those backflips and those like Simone Biles is like just, or even, you know, ice skaters, when they do those twirls and turns, they're going, you know, 20 twirls a minute. And then their cerebellum, like they've taught themselves how to override their inclination to like push away from the floor. They're actually like heading towards the ice. But how can we override these impulses? And one I've always found for me, and I found it to be effective for patients too, is also getting outside and pressing that reset button, and then just like physically being in a different headspace. Because even if they have like picked up the phone and maybe called somebody or listened to music or watched something funny, they just like, it's almost like they didn't realize, but it snapped them out of it. And it's like, oh, actually, I didn't want that plate of brownies. It's like, oh, what was I thinking, even that I was going to eat all of them? We need to sort of flip the switch. And I always think, like, if you think of like a gazelle is being chased by a lion, and if the gazelle gets away from the lion, the gazelle will go to the watering hole and hang out with its fellow gazelles and drink some water. And it's not going to be thinking about that lion who chased me. Oh my gosh, I'm so scared. And like, you know, going on and on and on about it. It's going to be drinking water and moving on. What can we learn from the gazelles in flipping the switch of maybe that thing was really stressful or annoying, or I didn't get to do that workout, or I, you know, was in that annoying traffic jam, but I can, how am I going to flip the switch and what works for me? And so I always have my patients have like kind of go-to tools. Like, is it rocking out to an Addison Rae, like, you know, song, or is it, you know, doing something that's like, that's what flips my switch kind of. And it could be just something funny, or there's like a go-to person they call, or maybe I just need to take a shower. Like, it's like those weird things that can be like, oh, I'm back.
Yeah. I love that. Just get the short list of things that help you flip the switch. Going outside, doing something for someone else, thinking about what the opposite thing you want to do is, music, a shower. I love it. We'll put those in the show notes because it's true. Sometimes you're just in a funk and it's not really what you want to do and you're not aligning your actions with your values, but something is making you want to either get a hit of dopamine, whether it's sugar or be a, you know, a lazy couch potato or whatever it is, but it's really not who you are and it's not what makes you feel your best. I love it. Let's go back a little bit to resilience. And because I do think you mentioned it, like resilient hair, like it's everywhere. And I want to support my kids to be resilient. I want to continue to be resilient. I want to be more resilient. It's hard to quantify. Like, what does it really mean? How do we build it? What does it look like in today's world?
Well, you know, I kind of tried to divide it in the book between what I call like big R resilience, that is the ability to bounce back. And that's the way the APA defines it, to bounce back after sort of a major life event. And it turns out that for the most part, people are unbelievably resilient. It's kind of the default. Like people, it's not something that we talk about enough, that our default mode is to be resilient, to at least return to that normal level of functioning. What I got really interested in as well was like post-traumatic growth. Like actually, what are people who actually feel that they've been transformed for the better in some way, that they have a renewed sense of purpose and possibility. They've deepened their relationships. They are a newfound meaning in their lives. And the research that really got me thinking though, was what about the everyday stressors? Like people who have like, you know, they say they have a lot of everyday stress in their lives. And more, that's what I've been finding, that patients I would meet, they weren't coming in at these big inflection points or after these major life events. It was just overwhelmed by the daily grind of just all this stuff, this game of whack-a-mole that they were playing. And that the research shows that actually people who have a lot of these kind of just daily stressors are much more vulnerable to, you know, mental illness, and it has a major and a bigger impact on their health and even these major life events. So how do we develop that little R resilience? Like, what does that look like for all of us? And so that's really kind of what I focus on this book, is the idea of like everyday vitality. And for me, vitality was this positive feeling of aliveness and energy that's at the heart of each day. And it's really a critical contributor to your everyday well-being, because it helps you feel that you're, you know, ready for anything. Like you can handle the hassles. And what was like the three core components to that were like, I call it like the three C's. It's like when you feel like you're connected to others, like you feel like you have genuine, meaningful moments with other people. It might be a stranger, it might be someone you live with, but so connected with others. When you feel like, then the second one is when you feel like you're contributing to something beyond yourself in some way. And the third one is when you feel challenged in a positive way, that you, you know, have the resources to meet whatever that challenge is. But, you know, what I call like desirable difficulty, like that idea that like there are things that you feel like ready for, that you can, like, if I put my mind to that, I can take that. And we always say it's like stress is all bad, but there are good challenges too, and good stressors that help us like sort of be our best, that like push us in ways. And especially in the form of, before we were talking about ways to help people be more flexible, having hobbies is an important like contributor to that. And a few years ago, I was asking an assistant, like I was interviewing, like, tell me about your hobbies. And she said, like, you mean, do I collect stamps? And I think like it sounded like this like really old lady kind of thing. And I was like, no, well, that's not exactly what I meant. But again, I think there was a lot of perfectionism in her life. And so in college, she had done some hobbies, but since then, like, she worked or she was on social media kind of. And so there was this, like, you know, or she would like exercise, but there was these sort of buckets. But having something you do outside of your sort of central role in your life, having other hats that you wear that are meaningful to you, that you do just for the love of the game. You're not there to achieve mastery or to win that marathon, but maybe you just like jogging because it's meaningful to you, you know, having things that you do just for fun that help you feel alive, that help you feel attached to your values in some way, I think is really important. I think we need a better word than hobby, though. So if you have one, I'd love it.
No, it's like happiness activities, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. What you just said, that we don't need to have mastery. I think that's really important for people to hear. I don't know very many people nowadays that don't take something on to master it. Like, I'm going to learn a language. I'm going to learn to play the guitar. I'm going to do yoga. I'm going to do Pilates. Like, they're going to be, they want to do the highest, hardest vinyasa flow in the heat, be up front doing their crow pose. And it's like, what about the fun of it? Like, how do we support people to have these happiness activities, to have these hobbies for fun? What do you suggest for clients who find themselves in, maybe they're a type A perfectionist and the goal is always mastery? How do you keep the fun?
You know, it's sometimes that they don't even realize. And the word fun or joy is so important. Like, what's something even that you remember as a kid that was really fun for you? You know, and it's something like where you felt alive and that you just sort of giggled, and maybe it was, you know, my daughter, it was ridiculous, but I remember like once, like I couldn't stop smiling because she made me like skip down the street with her. And I was so embarrassed at the time. And I was like, if anyone sees me, I'm supposed to be some self-respecting psychiatrist skipping down the street. Like, there's something sort of humiliating in it, but you can't help but smile when you do things like that. And I was like, that's kind of liberating and fun. And I was in a really bad mood that day too. So there's something. So what brings you joy? And what is that thing that, you know, you can do that is just silly and fun? And I think it's not something we're not playful enough. Like, we're good at having our kids be playful and kind of prioritizing like playtime. But what if it's, maybe it is, you know, clay, like, or pottery, or is it baking, or is there a place where you can experiment and just get really comfortable in your not so good at? Because there's a lot of stuff I think that we like to do, but we don't get to do it because we're not so good at it. And even like, I started playing tennis again and I'm really not good, but it's just fun to do that and to play around and actually like force yourself to like make peace with something you'll never be a star in. And it's so lovely and you can celebrate that. I used to like be that yoga woman you're talking about, be like the front of the class, like, you know, trying to get into every position. And I kind of secretly hated it. And I stopped doing it for like 12 years. And now I'm back. And now when I do like some of my like yoga app, I always choose the level 1-2 class. Like, it has to be like one that's going to be fun. And it's not that I'm pushing myself and I'm not hurting myself and I'm stretching myself. And it's that kind of desirable level of difficulty, but I'm not hurting myself and I'm not hating it. And I think we need to give ourselves permission for mediocrity and to have a lot more of that in our lives. And, you know, there are certain domains that we can really focus that achievement on. But when we're putting all that pressure to do it in every single one, it's just unsustainable and joyless.
I think what you're creating too is you're creating that everyday stress, that everyday grind in your own life by having these mastery goals with things that are supposed to be life-giving. And then all of a sudden we're in this place of the grind and the stress and the challenge, you know, these attainment goals that, like, not what are they for, but I think we just need to like live purposefully. Like, what do you really want to master? Be purposeful about that and be really good at that and have fun with the rest of your life.
And one way, I mean, I've got to say, for like those really type A people, you know, I try to highlight how like things that they assume are time wasting activities could actually make them more productive, you know, and that's maybe like a backdoor in sometimes with people who are resistant. They're like, why would I do that? Why would I get up from my desk and go for a walk in the middle of the day? Or why would I just even watch a movie? Or why would I just go for a walk in the park and just stroll, but not put on like my jogging shoes and, you know, put on like my gym clothes? Like, why would I waste my time? Like, everything like, I think all this productivity porn, like there's so much pressure to always be like super efficient and like making the most out of every single moment in terms of like the outcome, and like actually just enjoying the process a little bit more and reminding them that they'll probably be more productive and that as they're like a little bit happier or they'll be rejuvenated and revitalized in some way that actually that might help them concentrate or focus more. So that's sometimes my backdoor in with those types.
I love it. No, it's, I mean, because it feels like you're giving them the payoff in the end. You'll be more productive if you do this thing that's fun and life-giving, and they probably will, and then they'll have the best of both worlds. So let's circle back to the big R, because people do go through really big traumatic moments and they need to be resilient. You said that most people are programmed to be really resilient, and you see that in your clients and I'm sure your followers and the people that read your book. What advice do you have for people that are coming out of really big stressful events to bounce back or deal with that and have that big R?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it, we do live in a world though that puts a lot of pressure on us to be happy all the time. And I think giving oneself permission to feel and to go through something and have, I'm a big fan, I'm a positive psychiatrist, but I'm a big fan of negative emotions, you know, and sadness can be a signal, you know, feeling down can, it's data ultimately. Like, what is it telling you to do? And either I think people feel pressure to like just kind of suppress it or not deal with it. I had a patient who had lost a grandparent and she was really frustrated with herself for not snapping out of it. Like, and it was sort of that she was feeling guilty that she would have these like moments. Like, she was fine some of the time, but then she just had this moment, something would remind her of it, or she wanted to tell her grandmother something. And it was reimagining her grandmother and putting her like vocabulary when she just described her into the past. Like, her grandmother is no longer with us. Like, my grandmother does this. This is her favorite TV show. It's like, no, that was her favorite TV show. And sort of, you know, that transformation and sort of how she thought about her was hurtful every time. And it was hard, but she was putting so much pressure on herself to like be back. And why isn't she cheerful when she was going out with her girlfriends and stuff? And she didn't want to be Debbie Downer around them. And I do think we really need to give ourselves that permission to sit with some of the sadness and the challenges, even the anger. Like, what is that? And, you know, there's a lot of research too around what they call emotional granularity. It's being able to not just say like, I feel bad or like, ugh, or blah, but being really as specific as possible and being able to sort of put some language onto how we're feeling. Like, I'm really feeling frustrated because of this, or I feel despair because of that. Not just that like overwhelming, like bad. And I think we have this sort of binary approach sometimes to people's emotions. Like, things are good or bad. People are happy or sad. And oftentimes we can hold together moments of happiness and sadness. You know, you can have bittersweetness in things. And we see that sometimes when people are grieving, like they'll have these really fond memories or they'll laugh and they'll have a moment of connection with another family member or something that's meaningful, but then they can also be grieving. And how do we hold these emotions together at the same time and allow for that and not feel guilty because we're feeling a little bit sad? Or, you know, I think we put so much pressure on ourselves, and maybe that's tied into some of this perfectionism to just be smiling all the time. But we have so many feelings about our feelings that, you know, to kind of actually like give ourselves permission to feel and to, you know, but also when we are feeling down, I think to be deliberate about creating some positive emotions as well, because it is really important to have those uplifts balancing. I think those negative emotions, and then we'll feel like more capable of coping and dealing with them.
Definitely. Well, looking at the last year, whether it's like the headlines on the news or scrolling our social media feed, it does feel like there's a lot of negativity or heavy emotions and things that we're all sort of dealing with, and then coming back into our normal life, trying to have like these, maybe it's a milestone, your toddler walked, or you got a book deal, or you did something great at work and you got accolades to that. Like, it does feel like we're trying, you know, we're having to deal with a lot of emotions at once. Do you have tips for people dealing with kind of the world's emotion and taking those on?
Yeah. I mean, I think especially, I mean, the news, you, like, it kind of can't get any worse, and then it does. And, you know, all the doom scrolling that people do. I saw the other day, like, it's sort of this gallows humor joke. They're like, it's not doom scrolling, it's catastrophe renewing, you know, that they're like going through all of that. But look, the news, though, is a really, I think, a reservoir of misery. It's a vampire of vitality. And though that said, especially like women, I think, become kind of avoidant of the news. And like, I just can't deal with it sometimes. And so how do we like stay informed and feel like we're not being ostriches, though, and just like putting our heads in the sand, but not feel overwhelmed by it? And there's actually quite a bit research that shows that people can even not be at an event, like after the Boston Marathon bombings, like people who just consumed a lot of news in like the 2 weeks following that were more likely to have symptoms of post-traumatic stress than those who were there if they watched lots of news. So even like not even being at the scene of something like that, but like seeing it over and over again on television is really, really devitalizing. And I think can take a serious toll on us as we do it. So how do we, again, like kind of have agency and take control of how, when, and where we get our news, you know? And so to only sort of, you know, instead of following breaking news, maybe only check whatever your news feeds twice a day. And so you feel like there's more agency, only check stuff that like, you know, has been digested by reliable like sources. And also just to your friends, like don't, I kept saying this during like the beginning of COVID was to people like, stop sending your friends all of these like doomsday scenario stuff. Like it's not even valid. Like just don't be a spreader of doom in a way when you don't know necessarily, or you're just even forwarding something you've not even really read yourself. So I think how we're digesting news is super, super important. You know, when it comes to, you know, eco anxiety is really a big deal. And now we're almost calling it eco grief. And I think we need to be careful, like in my profession, not to over-pathologize something that's very real. And that if you're angry, if you're, you know, upset, like how can you get involved locally and do what you can? Because, you know, I know even during the elections, people were super engaged on a national scale. And especially young women were really, really like frustrated and irritated, and you know, with you know our president until just now, like it was just that level of rage and anger. But then people maybe weren't as engaged in their local politics. So how do you kind of? That's one way. Also, I think is when you feel like you're actually engaged and contributing and feel connected to the community that you're in and politically, or who's running, you know, for you know some a representative in your district or wherever you live is really important as well. And I think it feels less overwhelming and you know less stressful, and that you feel like you've got some skin in the game, and you feel like you're actually doing something of value.
Definitely. It takes us back to feeling connected, contributing, and challenged. It's those three C's that you talked about. I absolutely see how that could make you feel more empowered and more in control and very just positive in a time where you might feel negativity. I did see a quote, and I'm going to totally mutilate it, but it was about how we are like, our beings we're not equipped to deal with all the problems of the world. We're only equipped to deal with the problems of our village or our family or our town. And we're taking on so much, and it isn't our responsibility to have opinions necessarily and to have to digest all the information of things going wrong in other places. And that it is our responsibility to take care of our neighbors and our family and our friends in our community. And I thought that that was something that I needed to read at, you know, in that specific moment, just because it does, it's, you start to think about all the big problems and you don't have an answer and you can't make, it doesn't feel like you can make an impact or a dent in something. Feeling like you can totally changes the way you approach each day and how you take back your power.
Yeah, no, completely. And as you said, it's like that empowerment feeling of, well, actually, I can't affect any of that stuff going on. But here in this little, you know, domain, I can actually make a difference. And maybe my neighbor does need some groceries, you know, like in those little ways and in those small ways. And I think there's also research around how that's how we even get that sense of time back, you know, and we talk, people talk a lot about time famine and they feel like they have no time. And there's that pressure and stress around that. And it's super overwhelming, but actually like our free time hasn't changed that much. I mean, I know like on a Sunday when I look at like my phone, it's like, you've been on your phone, like this amount of like hours each day. So how do you actually spend your time more deliberately and take it back and embodying those values, doing things that feel meaningful to you and it might be sort of meaningful to someone else? And that's how you get more time affluence. And I think that's, you know, a very valuable way to sort of feel less stressed and more like vitalized.
I love it. Everybody wants everyday vitality. So let's close up today's podcast talking a little bit about that from your perspective. What does a day in the life of you look like to promote vitality, health, and happiness? And what does the science and research say to back that up?
A day in my life, how does that look? Sure. I mean, my dogs are reservoirs of vitality, and I spend the morning like looking around to make sure they didn't go to the bathroom somewhere in the house. And sometimes I have, sometimes I haven't. But actually, you know, I love like that time with them. They are, you know, just joy to me embodied. And I always try to spend some time outside in the early morning. You know, that's so important to me. I don't check my phone until about 8 o'clock. I don't want to listen to anything. Then I will hear the daily because I do love that and listen to that podcast. But I think it's very important to feel that I have agency going into the day and that I'm starting my day on my terms, not like being reactive to like what came in overnight and what I need to respond to. And so eating healthily too, like I do drink coffee. I love oatmeal. I love fruit in the morning as well. Like that's super important to me to feel strong and good moving into that. And I will see patients, phone calls, put out some fires and you know, probably that order. And I've always sort of vitalized by the experience of being with patients too. Like I find that to be a really like nice connecting way. I have to, by lunchtime, I always have to override my inclination to want to keep working through it. I mean, it's Groundhog Day for me every time. Like I still, like I won't get up and do anything unless I force myself to. And you know, in the afternoons too, I see some more patients, I do some more research, I do some work, but I always try to make sure I'm doing something. I'm on the board of something called City Meals on Wheels. And, you know, we deliver meals to homebound elderly, and we're now putting like a museum in a box for them. And I find that to be like super helpful. I love doing any kind of volunteer work that I can do with my kids as well, because even though they'll kind of kick and scream about it a little bit before we go, then it's sort of cool and it's fun and it's something that we've done together. So we were working at a food pantry this summer. But any opportunity even to have them feel empowered then, like I make them walk the dogs, I'll make them feed the dogs, like little things like that, that kind of, you know, you're going to live in this house, you have to contribute to it in some way as well. And what I've really been trying to incorporate into my life in the past year more is not gratitude, not the old fashioned kind. I mean, I think sometimes that we think of gratitude or the way it's been interpreted is like, oh, what are you grateful for? And like, oh, I'm grateful for this in my life. I'm grateful for my this or my that. And really the research shows that gratitude's effective when it's other oriented, like it's about other people. And you're really expressing appreciation for them and what they do and how they do it rather than being, you know, sort of how it benefits you. And so I think gratitude, apparently, like according to research, we all too often we keep it to ourselves because we assume the other person knows, especially those closest to us, or we don't know, we don't think we'll have the right words, or we're a little too awkward about it. And when we do that, we're denying them the opportunity of feeling good because apparently they really don't care about our eloquence, but we're also denying ourselves the opportunity of expressing it. So I've really tried to incorporate some of that in my everyday life. And even just like writing a little note, I have these like this postcards from the Metropolitan Museum of just ways that I can express gratitude to people for what I admire in them and for what they do in the world rather than like why their greatness benefits, you know, me in some ways. I've been actually really enjoying sending books to people with like a little like inscription of what I'm grateful for in them.
I love that. It's such a beautiful way to love on the people that take care of you, even though it's not directly reflective of how they're taking care of you. It's, you're making me want to end this podcast and call my mom.
Oh,
you know, it's just like, it's true. It's a lot of times we think they know and they don't. We need to be vocal and share why we love them so much and why they are just an amazing human being. Oh my goodness, Dr. Samantha, thank you so much for being here. It's been such a pleasure to have you. I love that you are focused on positive psychiatry and that you are a proponent of not letting people ruminate in the negativity, but they can feel their emotions, but it's really more about being a coach and helping them align their values with their actions so that they can feel connected, like they're contributing and like they're challenged, so that they feel better about their everyday life to create that everyday vitality. I'm so excited about your new book, Everyday Vitality. I'm so thankful for your time here today. This is going to be a really powerful episode for people, and I think really needed.
Thank you. Thank you. An honor to chat with you, and you are Vitality. So thank you.
Yeah. What a pleasure. Where can people follow along with you? Where can they get your book?
On Amazon, Everyday Vitality. And I would say give one to a friend too. You know, that was a way to do it. But I'm on Twitter, I'm at SamBMD. And on Instagram, I'm at Positive Prescription.
I love it. We'll link everything in the show notes, along with some of the nuggets of information that you said and shared with us today. And thank you again.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at BeWellByKelly.com and follow me on Instagram at BeWellByKelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.